Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. In about 15 minutes, Aaron Stile, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, will be here to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start the show with some of late summer's unwanted guests, wasps and fungi. And to tell us all about them, we have some very welcome guests. Laura Jesse Isles is an entomologist and the director of the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Charity.
And Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca is a plant pathologist and diagnostician with Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Lena.
Hi.
Thank you both so much for being here. And Laura, let's start with the wasps, which I think anytime you open a drink outdoors this time of year, you're bound to encounter a yellow jacket. But tell me about some of the wasps that we encounter during the late summer days.
Right. So a lot of our wasps, the yellow jackets and the paper wasps, they've got pretty big population numbers. Their colonies have just been growing all summer. But this time of the year, they're often, you know, pretty much done rearing larvae, which they feed proteins to their larvae. So they're out there eating caterpillars. So it's fall. They really have nothing to do but eat for themselves. So they're big, you know, sweet eaters. If there were more, you know, pollen and nectar, that's what they would naturally eat. But they are definitely attracted to our food, anything with sugars in it and drinks.
So this time of year, they are just feeding themselves. As we come in contact with them, is that a dangerous situation?
That can be dangerous. So, you know, there's kind of two times we come in contact with wasps. If you encounter a colony and, you know, those ground nesting wasps, if you've ever mowed over one of those, you certainly know how dreadful that can be because they're very, very aggressive when they're defending their colony and there can literally be, you know, dozens coming out to sting you. Luckily, in the fall, when they're coming to like a picnic or something like that, they're usually foraging away from their colony. So they're not as aggressive. They're not likely to just, you know, swarm you and sting you. They're going to sting you if you accidentally, you know, take a drink from your pop and there was one inside, or, you know, put your hand on one, or they feel like directly like they're going to be killed. That's when they'll sting you.
All right. So if you encounter a wasp, how should you behave? I realize your specialty is insect behavior, not people behavior, but we do get ourselves into trouble.
Yes. And so the big thing is to try to remain calm. So, and I know too, because it's not much fun when there's a wasp buzzing around you and, you know, you're afraid. And especially if you're allergic, you want to be very careful and, you know, have EpiPens and things available if you're highly allergic. But the more you keep calm, because if, you know, you move an arm and accidentally, you know, catch it in your elbow or something like that, that's when you're likely to get stung. So the wasp isn't trying to sting you. It's just checking to see, you know, if you taste good, if you're food, so it might land on you, but as long as you stay still, it will move off. I do kind of flick them off on occasion carefully.
So this time of year, as they are feeding, are they trying to prepare for the winter, or is this a last hurrah?
This is a last hurrah for them. So a colony of wasps, they breed all summer and produce all these workers, and these are just workers. And towards the end of the season, the colony itself will produce queens and kings, and those wasps mate, and then just the queen will overwinter. So it's just a handful of wasps from a colony that will survive the winter, you know, somewhere, you know, protected. But all these workers will die. So it's all females. They're all basically clones of the queen, and they're just out for a last hurrah.
Right. If you encounter, you talked about paper wasps, if you encounter a colony this time of year, is that something that you should take action about, or do you want to just wait until it freezes?
Right. So you can wait with first, you know, heavy frost freeze, it will kill off the colonies. But these colonies are large this time of year, especially those ground nesting wasps. And if they're near where, you know, people could encounter them, you do want to control those. If it's kind of above ground paper wasps, those wasp sprays that, you know, spray 10 feet, will work just fine. In the ground, you want to use a dust insecticide, you know, place that carefully at night. I always recommend, you know, if you're allergic, you know, you can hire a pest control operator to do this for you. But yeah, this time of year, if they're somewhere where people will get nearby, you want to control them.
All right. And I know a lot of people just really hate wasps. I mean, we don't like to be stung, obviously, and that response is pretty visceral. Why might we want to tolerate wasps?
Well, they're actually very good at controlling a lot of our garden pests. So as I mentioned, they're protein feeders during the year. So they feed the larva proteins. And one of the big things that they go after are caterpillars that feed in our garden. So if you ever see wasps, you know, crawling on leaves of plants and things like that, they're just searching for those pest insects. So they're really pretty helpful most of the year.
All right. And this time of year, if you encounter them, they are not necessarily serving those important roles, but maybe we can just give them a little bit of goodwill anyway.
Yep. It's, you know, important to keep food covered, you know, put something over your pop can. I think this is a benefit of drinking, you know, diet pop. So, you know, the more you can kind of keep them from starting to forage, you know, at your tailgate, at your picnic, the better off you'll be. And just be cautious when eating.
Do we also see a lot of bees this time of year?
Yeah, we do see, you know, if you've got late blooming plants, and certainly this year with, you know, large portions of Iowa with the drought and things like that, it's been, you know, hard for bees, all those bumblebees and, you know, honeybees to find things. So if you've got anything late blooming, I've got late blooming allium in my yard that they're just all over. And they're similar. Some of them are overwintering, you know, queens, but, you know, many of them won't survive the winter.
All right. Let's move on to some of this fungi that has been popping up around the state. Lena, I know that you've been getting a lot of calls about that. It was an incredibly dry summer, so fungi probably wasn't around very much. And then we got these late summer rains. What have you been hearing about?
Yeah, they're definitely loving the rain, the humidity. This type of mushrooms that we see popping up in lawns, they are just loving the temperatures and the fall weather. And so this is the time where they take advantage of that humidity, and that underground network of mycelia is just producing this beautiful mushrooms that people are sending us photos and questions about.
So when people get in touch with you, what kinds of questions are they asking?
Well, sometimes they're concerned about pets or kids, you know, getting in contact with them. And it's a very valid concern. There's a lot of mushrooms that can be toxic. So we always advise, you know, to be cautious and to monitor your pets and kids so that they're not in contact with them. As far as people always want to know what to do about them, and unfortunately, there's not a lot of treatments that you could do. You can pick them up, you can mow them, but they inevitably will be back. The good news is that they tend to be ephemeral, very quick. They will show up. They'll do their job of dispersing the spores, because this mushrooms, what they are is, imagine they're the flowering structures of fungi. So they're there to make seeds of them. So make little spores that then will go somewhere else to colonize other spaces.
It always seems kind of miraculous when they do just appear in a place where they haven't been. How long can those spores sit dormant before something happens?
Yeah, for a long time, depending on the mushrooms. But, you know, once that spore lands in there, it will wait until the right humidity is there to start germinating and creating that mycelia and fungal network on the soil. This happens also in lots of substrates. So, for example, wood, that could be stumps of trees, or it could be living wood like trees and shrubs. They may have been inadvertently wounded by the mower, or, you know, sometimes just injuries that plants may get. And that's how the spores will kind of land there and wait a little bit. And you may not notice a mushroom for many years because one may not be produced right away. And so when the right temperature, the right humidity, and enough mass of mycelia has been built in the location in the substrate, then it's time to create that mushroom.
Does it tell you something about your lawn if they pop up on your lawn?
Yes, absolutely. And it really depends. You will see fairy rings, like this, the circles of mushrooms on very healthy lawns. And in my backyard, I have one of those. And for those, it's more about the pines. They're associated with the pines, and they will come. And I expect them to be gone mid-October, and then it's all good. My dogs avoid it, so it's pretty good that they don't go around those. But sometimes, if your lawn is looking more of a dead looking area, it may mean that you have a lot of thatch in there that mushroom, those fungi are really enjoying and having lots and lots of nutrients for them. And so it may be telling you that you have to look a little bit closer to how you're managing your lawn to avoid that source of nourishment for the mushrooms, and likely for those mushrooms to be popping up pretty much every year.
With the derecho last year, do you expect that a lot more people will be seeing fungi in their lawns in years to come?
Well, I think it really will depend. I think in terms of, there was a lot of wood of trees and plants that were wounded by the winds of the derecho, and that definitely creates an entryway for a lot of this mushrooms. But like I said, this could take many years for them to be established in that tree or in that lawn, and then actually get a good production of mushrooms. For example, in my backyard, I've seen them twice in the 6 years that we've been in this house. And it really depends on, the humidity, the conditions, the temperature, and how much actually when we are mowing, how much of that we're returning, that thatch is building up or not.
Well, and for a fairy ring, like you mentioned, to appear, a perfectly circle or perfectly circular set of mushrooms, I mean, the conditions have to be exactly right when those spores are released, right?
And so, they're mushrooms and fungi, they create this hyphae, and they grow in circles, right? And so you have to create this really vast network of that hyphae, and the temperature have to be just right, and the humidity on the soil has to be just right for the mushrooms to start developing.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to answer your questions about plants and insects this hour. With me, Lena Rodriguez Salamanca, a plant pathologist and diagnostician, and Laura Jessie Isles, entomologist. They are with the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Aaron Stile, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, will be here in a moment. And you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. 9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects today. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Laura Jessie Isles. She is an entomologist and the director of the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Lena Rodriguez Salamanca is a plant pathologist and diagnostician with Iowa State University Extension. And Aaron Stile is also here, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Welcome to the show. And again, that phone number, 866-780-9100. Let's dive right in with some email questions. This one's from Susan. She says, I keep trying to grow blueberries in my orchard and I've had little success. I'm thinking about planting some in a raised bed, yay or nay? If yay, do you recommend planting in fall or spring? And what's the best way to prep the soil?
So blueberries are perfectly winter hardy here in Iowa, but it is challenging because they very much prefer a soil pH that is much lower than typical across the state. And changing soil pH isn't always an easy thing to do. So utilizing a raised bed may be a great way to get the soil conditions that these plants are really looking for. And to prepare that soil, I would build your raised bed. I would bring in some compost and topsoil and incorporate in that peat moss. Peat moss has a very low pH and will help bring the pH of that soil in the raised bed down. It probably would be beneficial to start with a soil test to kind of see where you're starting at. In much of Iowa, it tends to be kind of mid to upper sevens, and ideally a blueberry would be 6.5 or even a little bit lower. Creating a raised bed, incorporating a lot of peat moss with compost and topsoil in that raised bed will help get you those soil conditions that are lower in pH and hopefully will allow those plants to do better. I would probably build the bed in the fall and plant in the spring.
Is that something that you would also have to monitor and maintain over time, the soil pH?
Yes, you will. And you may have to incorporate, you know, compost can help. Peat moss would definitely help. If you ever fertilize, there are certain fertilizers that are more acidifying that can help lower the pH. Typically, we need to lower the pH. And this would be an area of the garden that I would do regular soil testing on to kind of see where you're at so that you can get those blueberries. Because boy, they are really good when they come right off of the plant.
They certainly are. She has a second question for you as well. She says, we have a pear tree that produced abundantly this summer. One of the lower branches peeled off partway and is resting on the ground. It is currently still green. What should I do with that branch?
Well, you could harvest the pears off of it when they're ready to be harvested. And then I would probably prune it off with a nice clean pruning cut just beyond. Don't make a flush cut. You want to leave what's called the branch collar and branch ridge or bark ridge, which are right where the branch attaches to the trunk or the main branch that it's growing from. So you'll leave that behind, make a nice clean cut. But if it's still green, I would leave the pears there until they're ready to harvest. You might as well get as many pears as you can.
All right. You can give us a call with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And remember, the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic is well represented here today. So if you've been having some trouble with insects or plant diseases in your yard or garden this summer, this is a great opportunity to get those questions answered. 866-780-9100. Felix is on the line in Manly. Hi, Felix.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I was calling in regards to Chinese swamp cypress. How do you grow one, and can you take clippings off a tree to get one started? And I'll just listen for your response.
All right, Aaron.
So this isn't a very common plant for much of Iowa, and I would have to double check it to see. It's not particularly winter hardy for us if we're talking about the same plant. So there are some closely related species like bald cypress and metasequoia that are similar and winter hardy, but what we typically refer to as Chinese swamp cypress is only hardy to zone 7, and Iowa is zone 5 in the south and zone 4 in the north. So it wouldn't do very well for us.
So getting it growing might not be that difficult, but keeping it growing would be a real problem, is what you're
saying.
Yeah,
through the winter, yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Mary is on the line in Polk City. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I recently moved from North Iowa to Polk City, and I dug up my Gallardia, which has been in my family for several generations, and it's in a pot right now. Just wondering if I am able to transplant that yet this fall, and if it will be successful. Thank you.
Yeah, you can absolutely, and actually I would recommend planting it soon. The more time it has to establish before winter comes, the more likely it will do better through the winter months. This very first year, if it's really, it sounds like it's an important plant to you, it would probably be beneficial to give it a little extra layer of protection. After the ground starts to freeze, usually around the end of November or so, add about 4 inches of mulch to the crown of the plant to kind of give it a little extra blanket. It'll also help keep it from frost heaving as much over the winter months. And then as soon as the ground freezes in early spring, usually around the middle of March, remove that excess 4 inches of mulch and allow that plant to naturally come out of dormancy then. That will hopefully help it even do an even better job of overwintering. But getting it planted as soon as possible and watering it in and watering it when it's needed until the ground freezes will be a really good first step.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Lena, we've got a couple of fungus questions coming in now. So be sharp. Mark is on the line from Dyersville. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
Okay, so we just moved back to Iowa from Wisconsin. And this summer I'd walk through the lawn, and we don't collect this orange dust on our shoes. We weren't sure what it was first, but I later found out it's a kind of a fungus that apparently appears when your lawn is stressed. And now it's gone. We've had some good rains, and I don't see it anymore, but I'm wondering, what do I do about this in the future?
Yeah, definitely. That definitely sounds like rust. It's very orange. As far as what to do, we actually have lots of recommendations on our website at thehornews.extension.istate.edu. Mowing, I would say avoid close mowing. Because that will be very detrimental to the grass. If I don't know if you're watering, but avoid night watering as much as possible during, you know, the season. And also checking the soil fertility on your lawn, because, you know, sometimes this rust will take advantage of stress lawn that may need fertilizer or that has been over-fertilized. Checking on that thatch again, because that's where the rust will overwinter. And so if you want to check on, you know, no more than half an inch of thatch in your lawn. And if it's really bad, then you may think about other grasses to incorporate in your lawn over time that may be better at getting less of this rust. And last, and in combination with all of this tactics, we'll be considering fungicides, but then we'll have to really give you a specific recommendation. So if you like to know more, you can send us an email to PIDC@iastate, and we'll be happy to share all this information too.
Well, and if it comes and it goes, it's easy to forget about it when it disappears, Lena, is it still something that he needs to worry about?
Right. You know, I have some in my own yard. I don't really worry that much. It just reminds me of, okay, how am I doing in fertility? I avoid watering my lawn because, you know, to conserve water, but also to avoid diseases. So yeah, it really depends on how much are you getting this rust? What is it expanding on your lawn? And really how much effort in terms of, you know, cost and effort you want to put on controlling it. Yeah.
All right. Mark, thank you so much for your call. And we'll go to another fungus question here from Katie. In my yard, I've found some kind of fungus. It's at ground level and is brownish, dry looking, half dome, about the size of a baseball. It digs out easily, but it releases a brown powder. What is it? And should I dig it out, or does that just make it spread more?
This somehow sounds like puffballs to me. So yes, every time that you touch it and it creates this cloud of brown dust, those are the spores. And yes, that you are helping it to move around. Again, those puffballs are normally ephemeral. And so, you know, if you just tolerate them for a little bit, they will be gone pretty quickly. And they may have the potential to come back next year, very similar time of the year. And if you want to remove them, then you may want to look for them before they're soft and ready to get those spores out. And that will be, you know, when they're young, you can remove them and they won't be ready to sporulate. They won't have that dust ready, but it's hard to time. So, you know, you may just want to leave them alone and that may be fine.
All right. And when she talks about them being brown, they're white before they turn brown, right? Most of the time, right?
Yeah. So they, you know, when before they're red, the spores are ready, they may be more of a tan color and feel harder. Then when they're ready to get those spores out, they're really soft and darker. Yes.
All right. And I know a lot of puffballs are also edible.
Yes. Yes, we do have one that we had some photos recently was a giant puffball, the white Calbacia gigantea. Those are huge. You will not miss them in the woods. And they are choice edible. You just have to be careful because when you talk about edibility, it's about the mushroom. Is it known to have a toxin to produce a toxin? Or it could be a sensitivity. There are some people that can't really digest mushrooms. So just be careful. At any time that you want to try a mushroom, just be careful and make sure that you know you're certain of the identity of the mushroom. And then if it's your first time, you determine it is edible, that is the first time trying it, just try a small amount.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Mike is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I have a mature pin oak on the southeast side of my house. It's probably 70, 80 feet tall. Provides great shade for the house and a deck on the south side of the house. My problem is about 10 feet to the east of that, I have a patch of about 8 by 20 patch of daylilies. And I was wondering the best way to get rid of those. I was afraid of digging them up, disturbing the oak roots, but I don't know if that'd be preferable to spray or how to get rid of those.
Aaron?
Are these the daylilies that spread rampantly?
Yeah, they're just the common orange daylilies that you see all over Iowa.
This is a difficult plant to eradicate, and it will likely, I mean, the safest option is going to be digging. And yeah, you probably will disturb some of the roots from that pin oak, but this tree is large enough and established enough, it will be fine. The hardest part about digging these daylilies is getting all of the root system. The roots tend to break apart very easily, and any little piece that's left behind will re-sprout. And so it will likely take several years to fully eradicate this area, whether you use digging or a non-selective herbicide. You could use a non-selective herbicide like glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. Roundup is probably easier to use as a herbicide than others because it is less active once it hits the soil. So it impacts green living tissue. As long as you apply it directly to the daylily, it's very unlikely to cause collateral damage to the plants around it. But the safest option is going to be digging. And whether you use herbicide or digging, you're going to have to attack this several times to get rid of these plants.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And last week on Hort Day, we were talking a lot about armyworms, Laura, because a lot of armyworm eggs seem to, or at least the moths that then laid the eggs, seem to blow into Iowa with some recent storms. Are you starting to get calls from people who are seeing them on their lawns?
We have not yet. They're just now getting, I'm seeing pictures of them hatching tiny caterpillars. So I do think, you know, if this is a very high value lawn or, you know, maybe a golf course, you know, definitely you want to keep an eye out for damage because the little caterpillars, they won't eat the whole blade of grass. They'll just kind of partially eat it. And so you'll see dead patches. But now we've gotten some reports, you know, in alfalfa and some things like that, but not widespread turf damage. So fingers crossed, we won't get that, but definitely keep an eye out for it.
Well, and if you're seeing videos of them hatching, it sounds like if we're going to see them, this is the week.
Yes, I think this is the week. If we get, you know, it looks like we're going to have continued warm weather, this, you know, and no rain, this would be great for the caterpillars. So yes, definitely a time to keep an eye out, particularly in eastern Iowa, where we receive most of our reports.
All right. And before we get to the break, one final question for you, Aaron, from Marlene in Ankeny. When should iris and peony foliage be cut back?
I would wait until the frost hits them, and for much of Iowa, that's sometime in mid-October. So wait for them to die back naturally from the frost and then cut back the foliage and remove it at that time.
All right. And as things start to look a little more brown, I think a lot of people do get eager to get out there and clip things, but we should wait. Be patient.
Should wait. Even if it has a little bit of that disease on it, it's still supporting that plant. And we still have at least a month for most of the state before we are going to see frost in most years. So we want to support that plant as much as possible still.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Aaron Stile, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And Laura Jesse Isles is here. She's an entomologist and director of the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Also from the clinic, Lena Rodriguez Salamanca, who is a plant pathologist and diagnostician. So it's a great day for troubleshooting here on Horticulture Day. You can join us at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Lena Rodriguez Salamanca, a plant pathologist and diagnostician with the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Laura Jesse Isles is an entomologist and director of the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. And Aaron Stile, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. They are all here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Sarah is on the line next in Radcliffe. Hi, Sarah. Sarah, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Great. What's your question?
So we are kind of getting up on tree planting season, as I understand, and we live on an acreage that did not have a very maintained tree line. So we need to do something with our windbreak. For more personal than practical reasons, my husband isn't a huge fan of evergreens, which is kind of the gold standard of what you should use. So we're kind of stuck as to what should we do anyway, because, you know, Professor Google Horticulturist says to use evergreens everywhere. And so we're kind of trying to figure out what should we do to kind of maintain, like, tree diversity. You know, you don't want all one kind. So what can we do instead?
Aaron?
Well, really, just about any tree can help break the wind, even if it doesn't have leaves on it. I would probably lean more towards some of the twiggier trees. So things like elms, maples, those kinds of things can be good additions. The other thing I would really strongly consider are a lot of the shrubs. So things like viburnum, red twig dogwood, hazelnut, and some of these other, lilac is another good one. Even without foliage on them, they have a lot of twigs. They can cut some of the wind. And many of them have other ornamental features through the growing season that can help with the appearance and those kinds of things too. So mixing those things in
rows with the trees, or would you do them separately?
Typically, they would be kind of layered in front of the trees from the prevailing wind. So you're kind of stepping up in terms of size. So smaller shrubs like nine bark and some of the viburnums might be your first line, and the red twig dogwoods might be your first line. And larger shrubs like hazelnut and lilac could be the next layer in. And then some of your more shade type trees. And even though they don't have leaves on them, it's true. Evergreens, because they have that foliage year round, are going to break more wind, at least the prevailing wind. Even those twigs and shrubs and that those multiple layers will help if you're not using evergreens.
Sarah, I am curious. Where does this deep-seated hatred of evergreens come from?
I think from being a teenager, having to mow around evergreens and constantly getting hit with them, and then not having grass grow, and I think it was mowing around them must have emotionally scarred him.
All right, I'm sorry. You had a follow-up question as well. What was that, Sarah?
If we did decide to, go to plant therapy and get over our evergreen issues, what are some of our best bets?
So, one of the best windbreak trees is probably one of the most unpopular ones. Is Eastern Red Cedar. It is very well adapted for much of Iowa. It grows very easily, but it is not the most attractive of trees. And there are many folks who don't love the way that this tree looks. It's actually a juniper. It's in the juniper genus, but we call it Eastern Red Cedar. Some other ones to look into would be firs, concolor fir, white fir. White pine would be another good option. And some of the spruces, I would lean away from Colorado spruce. It has a lot of very serious disease issues here in Iowa that make it not a great choice. But some of the non-native spruces, like Serbian spruce and sometimes Norway spruce, might be good options as well.
All right, Sarah, thanks so much for your call. Next up, Bob is on the line in Bettendorf. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I have an autumn purple ash, which is probably 35 years old, nice tree. It has been treated for ash borer all along the way, but this year I'm getting some limb breaking, but they seem to be healthy limbs. And I just wondered if it's just left over from Draco damage that they're finally breaking off or what. The tree seems pretty healthy, and that's it.
All right. Well, Laura, do you want to take that first and then Lena, or how should this go?
Right. So I think the first thing to do is to take a look at those broken limbs. There are some, wood-boring caterpillars that could possibly be causing damage, but where that limb breaks, you would probably see some fairly large holes and things like that in the wood. So I think we'd want to look at that area and see if we could start to get some information about what could be going on and take a look at some photos.
Sure.
All right. And then, Lena, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, exactly that. Good photos. See if there's anything on the breakage, if it looks mechanical only, or if it's like some changing in color and maybe the area looks kind of sunken. And good photos will be great, yes.
Okay. And work with the extension service on that?
Yes, you can go to your county extension on office, or you can send it to us to the PIDC, Plant Insect Diagnostic Clinic.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for your call. And let's follow that up with a mushroom question. Paul is on the line in Windsor Heights. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Yes. Hello?
Yes, go on.
I have a issue in my yard. I have some large mushrooms that grow in a corner of my yard. And it seems like every 5 days or whatever I go out to mow my lawn, there's these huge mushrooms. Best to describe them like elephant ears, and I don't know how to get rid of them. Is there a spray or a chemical to get rid of them? Because it's, I've literally by the buckets, I'm picking them out of the yard.
Elephant ears. What color?
They're brown.
Brown.
I actually have a picture of them sitting in my bucket. I don't know where to send it.
You can send it to us, the PIDC@ISTATE.edu. As far as how to remove them, it's so hard. They will keep popping up. I think, you know, if you may want to look in that area to remove any sources of food. There may be wood or wood chips, and then that may be a good idea there. Or if it's something, a shrub or another plant that is providing a lot of shade, you know, that may be something else to consider there. But they should be, you know, for a period of time, a month or two, and then as conditions dried out, they'd probably be gone.
You know, I have a tree that's relatively close to the area for my neighbor. It's looks like a maple, and it looks like it's stressed. Mm-hmm. And it's probably maybe 20 feet away. But and also there's an issue with creeping Charlie. Would either one of those have an effect on that?
Not the creeping Charlie. Perhaps the mushrooms may be associated with the maple. But again, if you have some photos, I'd love to make a full assessment of the situation there.
Okay, yeah, you gave me the address, but I didn't get it right.
It's a P as in plant. So it's just four letters. P as in plant. D as plant, PIDC, sorry, P as in plant, I as in insect, D as a disease, and C as in clinic. PIDC@iastate.edu.
All right. PIDC@iastate.edu. Paul, thank you so much for the call. And next up, we'll go to Ron in Des Moines. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we bought a house, about 3 years ago. And it's got a very densely shaded, sloped backyard. And I've replanted grass seed, dense grass seed, for the last 3 years. Every spring, it grows nice. But by this time of year, it's just all nothing but a few weeds again. I was wondering, is there some kind of ground cover that I could put in a deep shaded place on a slope? And there's also a couple of evergreens quite near.
Yeah, there are. So shaded areas just aren't happy places for turf grass. And it sounds like it can get started, but there's just not enough light to really keep it growing well.
Right.
And there are several different ground covers that you can use in this area. As with any ground cover, you'll want to make sure that you have good boundaries established, because some of these are a little aggressive, and that's a good thing in some situations to kind of cover the ground and get rooted in. But if they get out of their bounds, they can be really difficult to deal with. So
yes.
First one that comes to mind is going to be vinca or periwinkle is sometimes called. It's a creeping semi-evergreen. Gets a little pink or a little blue flowers early in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Also dead nettle or lamium is a nice one. Pachysandra can work well. A good native is wild ginger. And just one that sometimes folks don't think of, because you don't think of it as a spreading plant, but establishes very nicely in this place, is a hosta. They get quite large over time and cover the soil and root in nicely, so they can work in this situation too.
And hostas, you just plant them with a root, is that right?
Yep. So you can buy them from the store, obviously, or if you're getting divisions, you'll want each division to have at least two or three kind of growing points in it. That would probably be the smallest I would start with. Of course, bigger is okay too. So if you're getting them from a friend or something like that, and early spring is the best time to establish those.
All right, Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Next up, let's go to Mike on the line in Clive. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I have a question. I have a vegetable garden, and I've been digging up my potatoes over the last couple of weeks, and I'm finding grubs. I was wondering how to get rid of them and how to prevent them in the future.
Laura?
Right. So this is a pretty common problem, and we more often see problems with grubs, and these are, you know, kind of probably your white grubs. They generally feed on turf grass. So we really notice big problems with grubs, usually maybe the first few years after, you know, in a newer garden that may have been turf grass before, or if there is, you know, grassy weeds or things around there. There's really no treatments at all available for a homeowner. So it's really focusing on, you know, making sure there's no weeds or anything else in the area that the grubs can feed on. But yeah, it's a frustrating problem for potato growers.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Mike. 866-780-9100 is the number. And Jane is on the line next in Jessup. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My question is about, well, I have a couple of questions. My climbing clematis, we made a little place for it to climb up better, and so we transplanted it last year, but the flowers don't stay on it, and I had read something, well, you need bees to pollinate it for the flowers to stay on, so then that makes me wonder, well, should I put a honeybee nest in my backyard, but then what do you do with the bees in the winter? And so that's my first question. And then the second one is arborvitaes. Our trees we have 8 of them. They line our backyard, and they're quite tall, taller than they should be and wider. And I wondered, how much should we cut off at a time without hurting them?
All right. I think that's the easier of the two questions. So, Aaron, why don't you take the arborvitae question first?
Are you looking to kind of trim them down, like cut the top off?
Yes,
is that what you're thinking?
Because when we bought them, they were supposed to be like 8 foot tall. Well, they're probably more like 20, 30 foot tall. I told
sure.
They're quite tall and they're quite wide and they're impinging on the neighbors, you know.
Yeah.
So, width-wise.
It would probably be better appearance-wise and plant health-wise to simply replace them with a different variety. Cutting off the top of an evergreen like arborvitae, they don't re-sprout the same way that deciduous trees do. And you'll really compromise kind of the overall form and shape of the plant. It'll make it probably won't look nearly as attractive. And so if you're experiencing a situation where they're just too big, finding smaller cultivars, one that comes to mind right off the top of my head is one called Emerald Green that tends to stay smaller, might be a better option. Because if you just prune the top of these plants off, what it looks like the day you prune that off is what it's probably going to look like in 5 years. They won't change very much because they don't regrow the same way. And it's probably not going to be very attractive.
All right. And then let's return to that first question. Laura, did you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I would say that, you know, owning and maintaining honeybee hives is a big investment in, you know, time and money. It's certainly a very enjoyable hobby that many people do. You'd want to check any ordinances in your city to make sure that it's allowed. And then there are courses through the winter. You can check out with the Iowa Honey Producers Association for some training courses. But it is definitely, yeah, you know, you have to have quite a good level of knowledge to maintain honeybees. And usually there's enough pollinators out there just naturally to handle any pollination needs in a garden.
All right. So it's a real investment of time, energy, and even money if you're going to dive in there.
Yes, you have to really enjoy it and want to do it.
All right. And we've got a final insect question. Nancy's on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Nancy.
Yes. My question is how to repel wasps away from my hummingbird feeders and my oriole feeders.
That's a big problem right now. And I too have put out the jelly a few days ago and it was just unbearable. So I would say just open jelly is not really possible right now. They're definitely going to forage at it. There's really no way to repel them. With the hummingbird feeders, you want to make sure you have, you know, a bee guard or, you know, sometimes where they're kind of the sugar water comes down into the saucer, it's lower. So fortunately, the bees and wasps don't have very long mouth parts like the hummingbirds do. So anything you can do to keep them from getting at the sugar water. But it's a challenge for everyone trying to feed birds this time of year.
All right. Nancy, thanks for your call. And Laura Jesse Isles, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Laura Jesse Isles is the director of the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Lena Rodriguez Salamanca, thank you.
Thank you.
Lena Rodriguez Salamanca is a plant pathologist and diagnostician at Iowa State University. And Aaron Style, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Aaron Style, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, will be back with Hort Day next Friday on Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.